Do you want more true crime bedtime stories? Sign up to Bonus Bedtime Stories on Apple Podcasts today to access early and ad-free episodes. Subscribers will also get an exclusive bonus episode each month. But for now, get comfortable and enjoy tonight's episode.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to True Crime Bedtime Stories. In today's episode, we'll learn about the kind of man your mother always warned you about. A charming stranger with a camera, full of flattery and mystique. A man with a knack for spotting vulnerable young women with stars in their eyes and convincing them they were safe with him. Christopher Wilder would go on to be known as the Snapshot Killer. Elizabeth Kenyon was a vibrant young woman, admired for her warmth and beauty. At just 23 years of age, she was a beaming presence at Coral Gables High School, where she had dedicated herself to teaching emotionally disturbed children. This commitment to helping others was emblematic of her kind-hearted nature, yet it was clear to those that knew her that Elizabeth also longed for the glamour of the fashion modeling world. A realm where she had once shone brightly as an Orange Bowl princess and a finalist in the Miss Florida contest. Her life at this point seemed a balancing act between these two contrasting worlds. With her thick brown hair, arresting smile, and a charismatic energy that drew people to her, Elizabeth made friends effortlessly. It was this magnetism that inevitably turned men's heads wherever she went, leaving an indelible impression on those who were fortunate enough to catch a glimpse of her. On the 4th of March, 1984, as she had done on countless weekends before, Elizabeth set off from her Coral Gables apartment to visit her parents in Pompano Beach. However, this particular weekend was different. It bore the heavy air of foreboding. Elizabeth's father noticed unexplained bruises on her arms and legs. When questioned about them, Elizabeth appeared to dismiss his concerns, attributing the bruises to a schoolyard fight that she had broken up. Her parents didn't push further, but as the day progressed and evening turned to night, they couldn't shake a lingering sense of unease. Regardless, the evening wound down, and at 9 p.m., Elizabeth bid farewell, entering her car to return home. It was a routine departure, a benign moment in time, yet it was one that would haunt those she left behind. Her roommate remembered that evening precisely. Elizabeth had arrived home around 10 p.m., and as far as anyone knew, her night concluded uneventfully as she went to bed, seemingly to rest up for the work day ahead. The truth of the following day, however, would reveal a far more sinister narrative unfolding. Elizabeth attended her teaching job that next day, and as she exited the school, she shared a few words with Mitch Fry, the school's police officer and security patrol, in the parking lot. It was an ordinary exchange, a brief moment in passing, yet it would be laden with significance. Unbeknownst to Officer Fry, he would be the last person to see Elizabeth Kenyon alive. The next day brought a silence that echoed with worry. When Elizabeth did not show up for work, Officer Fry felt an alarm trigger inside him, one that prompted him to call Elizabeth's roommate immediately. The roommate's response was a cold tremor of dread. Elizabeth had not returned home the previous night, and there had been no word from her. No calls, no messages, nothing. It was entirely out of character for Elizabeth to leave without telling someone of her whereabouts, and it was this shift in pattern that set off a chain reaction of concern. Family and friends were called, hospitals were checked, but Elizabeth seemed to have vanished without a trace. The subsequent days passed with a growing sense of urgency, an unspoken fear escalating with each unanswered call. The Kenyon family filled out a missing persons report with a desperation that was matched only by the relentless ticking silence of uncertainty. It was in this state of alarming mystery that Elizabeth Kenyon's disappearance became an incarnate nightmare for those who loved her, creating a narrative punctuated by confusion, dread, and the hope that somehow she would be found safe and unharmed. The question echoed in the minds of all who knew her. Where was Elizabeth Kenyon? Determined to transform their worry into action, Elizabeth's parents turned to Kenneth Whitaker, a private investigator. Whitaker dove headfirst into the tempest, sifting through the fragments of Elizabeth's life to piece together a narrative that might lead to her whereabouts. It soon became clear that Elizabeth's personal life, much like her public life, was full of connections. She treasured friendships, had professional liaisons, and yes, romantic entanglements. He discovered a tapestry of relationships, including a recent dinner date with an international suitor from West Germany, a rekindled flame with a former partner, and the occasional outings with an ex, an erstwhile gentleman by the name of Christopher Wilder, a photographer. Wilder, in particular, painted an interesting figure in this mosaic of men, a friend and suitor whose proposal of marriage Elizabeth had declined, citing the age difference. But even in the face of rebuff, Wilder remained close, bound by the ties of friendship, or so it seemed. As Whitaker delved deeper, the fabric of Wilder's sophistication began to fray. A visit to Elizabeth's parents had them reveal a cautionary clue. She mentioned Wilder had offered her some glamorous modeling work for good money, a statement that would later flicker a warning signal. When Whitaker approached Wilder, the man was draped in the disguise of innocence, asserting he hadn't seen Elizabeth for over a month. With his alibis neatly laid out, it was a disappointment for Whitaker. The other romantic interests failed to materialize as viable suspects, too. But it was not in Kenneth Whitaker's nature to be deterred by dead ends. With the precision of a craftsman, Whitaker continued to chip away at the blockade until an unforeseen breakthrough. Another former beau decided to pass around Elizabeth's picture at her usual haunts. And there it was, at a Shell gas station in Coral Gables. An attendant, unsuspecting, held the thread Whitaker needed. Elizabeth had been there the day before her disappearance with Wilder, covering her bill. Wilder was now front and center, his alibi cracked by incredulity. The discovery of Elizabeth's car abandoned at Miami International Airport entwined the narratives further. She hadn't packed, and it was doubtful she intended to travel. Subsequent revelations about Wilder only thickened the murk. His history was not one of just brushes with the law, but was etched with the violence of sexual offenses. If only innocence could be assumed, but as every true crime enthusiast knows, assumptions are the enemy of truth. Thus began the weaving of this tragic story, where sentiment and fact wound tightly, where every thread pulled could unravel a life or tighten the knot on a mystery. As Elizabeth's family grappled with grim possibilities, Kenneth Whitaker's meticulous pursuit of leads was setting the stage for something bigger, something far more heinous than anyone had anticipated. The puzzle of her disappearance deepened as multiple facets began to align in an alarming portrait of possibility. Christopher Wilder, the gentleman, appeared more and more to be a suspect cloaked in deceit. Yet despite growing suspicions, Law enforcement was bound by the constraints of a missing person case and kept at bay, prompting Bill Kenyon to take an active role in shadowing Wilder's residence, delving into a personal hunt for answers. Bill Kenyon's persistence in the investigation uncovered that the Boynton Beach police had compiled quite a rap sheet on Christopher Wilder. Far from the model citizen Beth believed he was, Wilder had a disturbing track record plagued by sexual offenses. It seemed that the gentleman veneer Beth once spoke of might have masked a much more ominous figure. This new revelation jolted Beth's parents with a searing dose of reality. The night they last saw their daughter, a television report had flashed another missing woman's face across the screen, a woman who bore an uncanny resemblance to Beth herself. Cold dread set in with the realization that their daughter's disappearance may not simply be a singular tragedy, but part of a much darker sequence woven by the hand of Christopher Wilder. Peeling back the layers of Christopher Wilder's life is like delving into a psychological thriller where the villain is both the central character and the monster lurking in the shadows. Born on March 13, 1945, to an American father and an Australian mother, Wilder's first breath was nearly his last, facing the Grim Reaper so early that a priest administered last rites. But he survived, setting the stage for a life shrouded in darkness. Childhood for Wilder was a train of medical emergencies defined by a near drowning at 2 and convulsions that left him unconscious a year later. The semblance of a stable family life did little to curtail the deviancy that brewed within. By early adolescence, he was window peeking, creeping into the very essence of voyeurism that would haunt his later predations. The wild coasts of Sydney, Australia, were his teenage stomping grounds, where, at just 17, he joined a pack of predators for the gang rape of a girl on the sand, a crime to which he pleaded guilty. His punishment? A year of probation paired with the still controversial electroshock therapy. The outcome was far from rehabilitative. His darkest desires were not only invigorated, but took a sharp turn towards the electric, sparking fantasies of shocking women during the throes of sex. Wilder's view on relationships was spotlighted in his whirlwind marriage at 23, a union dissolved after an explosive 8 days when his bride uncovered his collection of nude photographs and dark sexual tendencies. The United States greeted Wilder a year later in 1969, and he flourished from day one. His lies of a successful past in construction and real estate in Australia were well received, and in the night shadows, the predator paced, his roving camera eye seeking models. In 1971, his mask slipped, and his pursuit of women to pose nude for his lens got him a slap on the wrist in the form of a fine. Yet Wilder was a creature of habit, returning to his familiar M.O. with chilling regularity. His assaults grew in both frequency and intensity. A high school student working a renovation with him became his next victim, coerced into sexual acts. The court system, which failed her, letting Wilder stand trial only to see him acquitted by the jury. They had been meticulously fooled by his Jekyll facade when Wilder sat with therapists, his admissions of masturbation to the violent images of rape that his mind engraved, to the judge, to the therapists. They were a successful plea for leniency. Between 1971 and 1977, Wilder faced various charges related to sexual assault in both Australia and the United States, ranging from coercion to abduction and rape. A court-appointed psychologist deemed him a mentally disordered sex offender and declared he should be in a residential program. He never served jail time for any of his offenses. By 1982, Wilder was back in Australia and facing charges of indecently assaulting two 15-year-old girls he'd met at Manly Beach in Sydney. His parents posted bail, and he was allowed to return to Florida to await trial. So began a bloody crime spree that would cost at least 8 American women their lives. At just 20 years old, Rosario Teresa Gonzalez vanished not long before Elizabeth Kenyon's own disappearance. The parallels, unsettling in their closeness, began to coalesce into a pattern no one could ignore. Gonzalez, like Kenyon, had aspirations in the world of modeling and shared a similar allure with her dark eyes and long brown hair. She had gone missing on February 26, 1984, from the Miami Grand Prix racetrack, where she'd been working as a track model. Reports indicated she left in the company of an older man, a chilling detail that swiftly caught the eyes of the investigators. Gonzalez hadn't even collected her paycheck, an action entirely out of sync with someone planning to leave willingly. At this point, the same name cropped up in their inquiries, Christopher Wilder. He too was known to frequent the Miami racetrack, a space that seemed less about sport and more an opportunistic hunting ground for him. The scenario was eerily familiar. Both women had been involved in beauty pageants, both had caught the eye of the same photographer, and now both had disappeared into thin air. As the investigation delved deeper into his connections with both women, a sickening reality came into focus. A private investigator engaged by Kenyon's family brought to light Wilder's deception. He had indeed seen Beth Kenyon just before she disappeared, despite his claims to the contrary. It seemed he had lured her with the promise of a lucrative modeling job. The inquiry had shifted, no longer a search for an outlier incident, but a full-fledged manhunt for a serial offender. The red flags were hard to miss. Wilder had been at the Miami Grand Prix, his presence an ominous shadow cast over the event where Gonzalez was last seen. He had told sordid lies, and his past was littered with sexual offenses, hardly the gentlemanly image he'd presented to Beth. Authorities, having been swayed by the increasing evidence of a predatory pattern, were now pursuing not just a suspect in a missing person's case, but a man who was likely a dangerous serial kidnapper, if not killer. This realization prompted a profound change in tactics. The case was thrust into the public eye with renewed vigor, and information was disseminated widely in the hopes of eliciting tips from the community. As the case unfolded and the dark past of Christopher Wilder unfurled, what had begun as a search for one woman evolved into a sinister narrative of a man who could be responsible for a series of abductions. A litany of heartbreaking disappearances began to link together, forming an alarming constellation of tragedy with Wilder at its center. A profound unease settled over the communities affected, as what had been an isolated fear turned rapidly into a collective nightmare. The truth of the situation bore down heavily on investigators and the families of the missing alike, a cruel acknowledgement that there was a monster in their midst and he was hunting. It was up to the authorities to track down the hunter before any more lives were snuffed out in his deadly game. As the unsettling reality of Elizabeth Kenyon's disappearance began to unfold, a sinister figure emerged from the shadows. A man whose charm and reputation as a photographer and race car driver masked a malevolent predator lying in wait. This man was Christopher Bernard Wilder, and, as investigators would soon discover, his crimes stretched far beyond the state of Florida. He was embarking on a gruesome nationwide spree. Wilder's method of entrapment was as calculated as it was cruel. Posing as a photographer seeking models for legitimate work, he tapped into the dreams and aspirations of young women. His promises were laced with opportunity, a chance to step into the world of modeling, a world that many young girls saw as glamorous and full of potential. But behind his scouting facade was the harrowing intent to abduct, and as we tragically learned, to kill. The journey of terror began in Florida, but rapidly expanded across America. Wilder, driven by his demented impulses, crisscrossed state lines with a singular, chilling goal in mind. He was most comfortable behind the wheel of a car, and it became his vessel for terror as he drove from town to town, mall to mall, scanning for his next victim. In one instance, a 21-year-old vanished from a shopping center in Melbourne, Florida. Terry Lynn lived barely 2 hours away from where Wilder had set off. Her abandoned car served as a silent testimony to the grim fate she likely met. Fishermen, days later, would find her body, confirming the worst fears of those who loved her. With every victim, the FBI's net widened. Authorities from each jurisdiction were piecing together a series of kidnappings and murders that were as systematic as they were sickening. They now recognized a pattern, one that pointed unerringly to Wilder as the suspect. But the net was not closing fast enough. In Texas, a 24-year-old nurse and young mother reported an unsettling encounter with Wilder days before she, too, disappeared. Her lifeless body would be found, the horror of her final moments reflected in the manner of her death. As leads and bodies surfaced, so too did sightings of Wilder. One moment he was in Oklahoma, with reports of another woman spirited away, never to be seen again. Hours later, he was spied in Colorado, where an 18-year-old vanished after being approached by a man in a mall about a modeling job, a man whose description matched Wilder's. The horrifying pattern was unmistakable. Young, attractive women lured with promises of a modeling career, only to be ensnared in a lethal trap. Like a phantom, Wilder eluded capture, stealing cars and sliding between state lines with a distressing ease. New Mexico, Nevada, and beyond, wherever he went, heartbreak followed. He would even travel as far as Los Angeles, California, before swinging back towards the east. It was as if America itself had become his perverse playground. The turning point came with a fortuitous break. A teenage girl, subjected to untold horrors at his hands, survived. Her ordeal ended not with the death that Wilder regularly dealt, but with a courageous escape that provided law enforcement with a much-needed witness. A glimpse into the killer's modus operandi and a confirmation of their worst fears about his activities. This information spurred the FBI into a concentrated fury of action. Bulletins were sent out. His photograph was splashed across newspapers and aired on television screens nationwide. The country now watched with bated breath as a manhunt of exceptional scale unfolded. Roadblocks were set up. Tips called in. No stone was left unturned in the pursuit of the man who left a trail of devastated families in his wake. In the end, it was a chance encounter with law enforcement near the Canadian border that brought Wilder's reign of terror to a violent close. It was New Hampshire, a state typically more renowned for its tranquil beauty than scenes of violent crime, that would become the unexpected stage for the final act. In a small town mere miles from the whispering promise of sanctuary across the Canadian border, the killer's odyssey came to an abrupt conclusion. The scene unfolded almost cinematically on April 13th, a Friday laden with its own superstitious lore, at a quaint service station in Colebrook. Almost as if compelled by a force beyond himself, Wilder drew unwanted attention. Two state troopers, acting on little more than instinct and a resemblance to the wanted posters that peppered the country, approached the man who was under the sun's glare. What happened next was as quick as it was chaotic. Shots fired in a frenzied struggle for Wilder's gun. When the dust settled, a trooper was wounded but alive, a testament to the unyielding determination of those who chase shadows to bring light. Wilder lay dead, a single bullet interrupting the chilling narrative that had held a nation captive. In his possession, a litany of the paraphernalia of control, the handcuffs, duct tape, even a novel that mirrored his own twisted fantasies, but no longer would he impose his dark will upon the innocent. No longer would families wonder where he prowled. The relief was palpable, but so too was the somber reflection on what had transpired. Despite the close of Wilder's living story, his legacy was one of anguish. The victims' families were left to grapple with the loss, the absence, the endless procession of what-ifs. And for some, there were no answers, only the interminable silence where a daughter's laughter should be. Survivors, witnesses, and a nation bore the scars of Wilder's brutality, while the ultimate judgment was rendered not in a courtroom, but on cold, unforgiving asphalt. Many questions lingered, forever haunting, forever echoing in the void left by his untraceable steps. Wilder's spree had ended, but for countless others, the journey through the long night of his memory had only just begun. They were the ones who would keep the vigil, standing sentinel over stories that must never be forgotten, ensuring that justice, though delayed, would not be denied its voice. For more about this and all of our episodes, check out our True Crime Bedtime Stories Instagram and TikTok accounts. Join us next time for True Crime Bedtime Stories. Until then, sleep tight.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list. Teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.